You'd have wanted me to pay you.
Thank you, Dave. Appreciate the invitation. Good to be here. Good to be in a function. Certainly would, and I'm not going to start calling particular names, but those that invited us down, again, thank you. We extend the hand of the courtesy that you extended. And my wife certainly is with me. Those of you that have not met Barbara, well, babe, raise your hand. She's a member of the fellowship, sober a little over 30 years, and it's kind of like was said, you know, everybody's got a load to carry. It just kind of depends on how you carry the load. She does a good job. She gets me places that I'm supposed to be. And I appreciate hearing the long form. We have dessert nights, and that night we read the long form of the traditions. And I'm sure y'all wouldn't, certainly the newcomers are not going to be aware, but we had people with more than a year sober. After that had been read, they come up and after the meeting and say, "Where did y'all get that? That was read." Said, "We would like to get a copy of it." And I said, "Really?" I inquired if they had a big book, and they did. They just didn't know much about it. But it's good to sit in a meeting and hear that. I'm Bob Smith, and I'm an alcoholic. It's by the grace of God, people like y'all in this recovery program, that I'm able to be here sober. My dry date's August the 5th, 1964. That's 10 or 15 minutes at a time or an hour at a time, and it's not my first dry date in here. And I had a little time out for bad behavior. I first got sober in September of 62, and I got invited to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1958. The preacher that invited me, and I had several preachers. I didn't call them. Somebody sent them. And this one and I got to be good friends. And, in fact, he's the one that invited me. He said, "Bob, you might consider going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, "Well," I said, "Dr. Raphael, I don't know what they do there." He said, "Really, I don't either." He said, "We let them meet in a room back there in the back part of the church. It seems that when I've walked down the hall, I've noticed that they seem to drink a whole lot of coffee, they smoke a lot of cigarettes, and they don't drink." And I said, "I don't really want to go." And I didn't. I'm a guy that, and it's a pleasure to be among y'all, I'm a guy that was born down at Cleburne. They, I guess, got me out of there as soon as they could. I was about 2 when they took me to West Texas. I'm most blessed. I know who my mother is. Or was, and I know who my dad was. And I know there's people sitting in this room that don't have that privilege. I had a lot of blessings in my life, and I had no awareness of any of them. I just didn't know. It's kind of like tonight. It's good to see. Y'all had this meeting over here on Halloween, and you had a spook come over here and talk. And the spook has returned to the scene. And see, Bunky, he's kind of he wants to all go to fundraisers and stuff like that, and it's kind of like the preacher. And it's in a rural community that new preacher on the job, and there's things there that he needed to get changed and added on to and redone a little, and so he gave this good pitch about how they maybe were going to pass the basket another time or something and start trying to get some funds to whirl on down the line. Well, they can do some of these things they'd like to do at the church. He got up and made that pitch and did a pretty good job and had a pretty good little offering at the end. And looked at it, and Ms. Jones down there gave him a big check. he'd met her. She's just a lady in the community, lived off of Social Security and just minimum everything. Next week, same deal. Ms. Jones got the big check in there. This went on for about 2 or 3 months, and every week Ms. Jones is putting it in there. Preacher, he got next to her after one of the meetings and says, Ms. Jones says, you know, we're just asking that people put a, you know, just a token amount in, and says, we had no idea that you had that kind of money. Ah, she says, preacher, don't worry about it. Says, my son's a veterinarian. Said, he's a veterinarian. Yeah, yeah. Says, he got a cat house in Odessa and one in Waco. And y'all can talk to Bunky after the meeting. For the ones that raised their hand and acknowledged who they are, certainly welcome. I think it's a big step for any of us to show up at an AA meeting. I wasn't that privileged. The first one I came to, I was drunk. I didn't come there because that's where I wanted to go. The only reason I came is to get back in the house. My key didn't work anymore. And that was part of the drill. I went in there, heard people say things that we didn't even talk about at the bootleg joint. I looked around and they were, guys got up to the podium and said this and said that. End of the meeting, they come to the same drill then they do now. Won't know if there are any newcomers there. I'm pretty flexible drinking, and especially drunk, and I raised my hand as some others did, and they welcomed and clapped, and I questioned that, and they got to the spiritual part. And back then, in that time frame, they said, you know, if you don't have any a dollar to put in and you need to, we'll take one out. Well, it was pretty nice by the time it got back to me, but they watched the basket. And, but anyway, after the meeting was over and they got to the end of it, they said, we'll stand and close in the usual manner. And they said the Lord's Prayer, and I couldn't even remember the words to it. People came by and shook my hand and told me to keep coming back. I'm trying to get to the door where I can get outside and get a drink. A guy tapped me on the shoulder, and I turned around and looked him over, and he had some kind of tinted glasses on, one of them beginner mustaches, and he had a suit and everything on and a tie, and he stuck his hand out, and he said, my name's Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. That's nice. And anyway, I had no idea. You see, you may know what you may have known what an alcoholic looked like when you got to AA. I did. I knew what an alcoholic looked like. Lubbock's always, up until a few years back, it's always been dry. And a bootlegger my dad bought whiskey from. Back when I was 12 years old, he'd say, go down to Floyd's and get some, here's 20 bucks, get me 2 fifths of whiskey. And I'd get down there and knock on the door. I started riding a motorcycle at a young age, and the cops knew me, and this one knew me, and I got away with everything. And I got down there and parked behind it, knocked on the door, and his wife Sylvia came to the door, and I hear all this heck raising going on in there, and Sylvia says, don't pay attention. She said, Floyd's drunk. He's in the bed. And I could tell he's raising Cain, and she says, come on in, and I did. I handed her the 20, and she said, well, let me put them in a sack, and she was doing that. And Floyd, he's hollering in there, said, Sylvia, get in here and shut that light off. Said, it's just running me crazy. And about that time, I hear this noise, and it says, boom! And Floyd, he hollered out at Sylvia, says, that's all right, Sylvia, I shot her out. He took a shotgun, shot the light out. Now, Floyd was an alcoholic. I never had done that. So I created that indifference and it stuck in my head. I really didn't need, I'd been sober before. Why do I need to go to AA? The people just get sober there. And so I started walking a little bit more after Joe introduced himself. And, well, he says, Bob, do you live here in town? I said, yeah. My lifestyle back then was, I had an unlisted telephone number and a whole bunch of stuff. And I had a wife and three kids. I don't know. I had a lot of trouble keeping all the utilities running at the same time. And it just wasn't fun. We made a few steps, and Joe says, well, says, is there other people in your home that drink? And I said, no, she needs to. And he said, well, is she here? I said, that's her. She's trailing. And he said, well, said, now we have a program here for people, for the non-drinking, a loved one or a member of the family that doesn't drink. And I said, okay. And he said, she's more than welcome there. And I said, that's fine. And said, this was the only thing that was said at the meeting made any sense to me. Joe says, you know, Bob said, really, whether you realize it or not, she could be as sick, if not sicker, than you are. I stopped and started talking to Joe. Because he knew. Now, I don't know how he knew, but I knew he knew. I got out of there, and probably in 2 or 3 weeks, it was necessary for some other people to do a little thinking for me. And used to, you could go down to the county judge and fill out some commitment papers, and they did. They sent me to Big Spring State Hospital, and they put me in a little beginner hospital they had down there. And I kind of was whiskey whipped, and if at that ad building they'd have wired me up to a lie detector and asked me if I was an alcoholic, I'd have said no, and I don't believe the needle would have quivered. See, I didn't get to AA as an alcoholic. I just got here as a drunk. That's what I thought I was. That's what I believed I was. That's what people call me. I raised quite a little bit of cane over there at the hospital talking to. She wasn't Nurse Hatchett. She's kind of short for her weight. She ought to have been about 6'8", and she's about that tall. And I kept hounding her for a drink. And persistence paid off, and she said, if you'll just sit down in there and be quiet, I'll get you something to drink. And a little while, she brought me a glass about that tall, yay big around. I smelt, and it didn't smell good. She said, don't be smelling of my stuff. Said, just, if you'll drink it, it'll work. And I did. And that's when I met Peraldehyde. I'd been around people that strained some canned heat, and those that drink some vanilla, and I mean, we got winos and winettes out there, and then we got people that if it won't pour, they just chew it. And I never had met this stuff, but I had me two more of them while I was over there. And she's right, it works. And I take me over to this ward, and I make 8 or 10 steps up on that floor, and I see a guy I know. It's not a guy I like. It's not a guy that... ex-assistant high school principal of mine's in here. I asked this attendant, I said, is he in here? He said, oh, yeah, I wasn't glad to see him. I want to get even. And that's when I met Shelby, and he's the one that cracked the whip and run the show. And I wasn't very good in there. I got drunk a couple of times while I was there. The last occasion, well, he called me in his office, and he says, you know, Bob said, I'm aware that you're not very sincere about nothing. But here's the deal. You pull in more of these shiners like you've been pulling. Well, said, I'm going to send you over to Ward 5. Over there, they will plug you in. You will live better electrically. I was model after that. I didn't want any shock treatments, and that was the offering. There's kind of like any other place. I mean, you eventually get out, and I went back to the house, and We're in the process of getting a divorce. And the phone rang. It still worked some way. And it was Joe. He called me and told me that he'd be by after me in about 30 minutes and was going to a meeting. And we started doing that. I had heard prior to that when people said a dry date. I finally found out what a dry date was. We went to meetings, met people. I went to places I didn't even want to go. We met people. I found out that AA's around West Texas in different communities. And we was going to La Mesa one night, and Joe, certainly he's driving because it's his car. My vehicles, I appraised them at about $300 apiece. I'm sure that was high. And he kind of ricocheted off of one of those, it wasn't a guardrail, it was one of them little, they didn't handle orange things, it's made out of wood. And I said, Joe, didn't you see that deal? I said, it's over on my side. No. He said, he's got a glass eye on this right side. I said, well, come find out, well, he had one ear he could hear out of. He had a hearing aid on it. Then he had a glass eye, and then a little later on, well, he had a bad leg, and they sawed it off and gave him a store-bought one. And, see, I don't know that I ever asked Joe to be my sponsor, really. I thought there were several of them got together over there, and they drew straws, and he lost. And he took me places. He introduced me to people. He helped me fill out a card. I'm a guy that sat in meetings for 2 or 3 months. When they passed the basket, I didn't have a dollar to put in it. That's a little humiliating for me. Later, if there's anything worse for me than bad fortune, it's good fortune. And later, I got to where I could put stuff in the basket, and I hit the ground running. I know how to play catch-up. I'd done that before. I went along, and I got away with a lot of stuff. Sure, these steps are numbered, 1 through 12, and I could admit and accept that, and Joe squeezed it out on me, that you know, if your drinking interferes with your way of life, there's a good possibility you've got a drinking problem. And this went along, and if I didn't like that step, I skipped it. And I got away with that. The fellowship carried me for a long ways. And, you know, I went along, and at the group I went to, at the end of a year, they bake you one of those $1.29 cakes, and they put a candle on top of it. They light it, and they give it to you. They gave me one, and I looked at it, and I said, is this it? They said, that's it. And see, already by that time, I'd traded work boots and work clothes for alligator shoes and silk suits, and I went to meetings and heard people say stuff. I didn't really hear what people said from the podium. I probably heard what I wanted to hear. There's a lady up there one night. She says, you know, now, if you want anything if you want what I have and willing to go to any length to get it, this is the step she take. And I punched Joe. I said, listen to her. She's advertising. And he would always look and tell me, he said, Smith, you're the dumbest thing I have ever worked with. And he had me set chairs, set tables. I got their attention when they made me make coffee because I wasn't familiar with 100-cup deals of coffee. And I didn't even like it myself, so I got a cup and got over in the corner of the room, and I watched them. They didn't like it either. They wanted to know who did it. So I didn't last long at coffee making. I mean, I still make coffee, don't misunderstand me, but there was a lot of time they had to teach me. I walked in there one day, and we had a house lady named Nita Bell. And Nita Bell just hunkered over. She was just down, and I said, what has happened? Like she's lost her last friend. She says, Bob, you didn't know. And I said, no, I don't guess I knew. Oh, she said, it's terrible. I said, okay. She said, did you know that the treasurer got drunk? I said, no. Yeah, and run off with all the money. I said, really? So I got me a cup and sat down with her. And I said, and she went on some more. And Nita Bell been sober a long time. She sobered up in the late 40s. And I said, finally, Nita Bell, how much money did they get? She says, I'm not sure. It's $27 or $8. There's always been a constant flux of everything in AA. I've had the privilege to be around it and be a part of it. At about 20 months, well, a boy called me and he says, Bob, I want to come over and talk to you. I said, sure. As arrogant as I was, I thought he wanted to know something. And he came over and he visited a little bit and he said, you know, Bob said, if you don't do something about this dry drunk you're on, said, you're going to get drunk. He said, I experienced it myself. He said, I got sober in AA, I think he said in 1948 or 1949, and he says, I got to doing a little light chipping around, drinking little bitty drinks, and I got to eating me some pellets. And I finally ended up getting drunk. And he says, you know, I didn't get back to AA until 1961. And Johnny, he kind of sat there and like he was through. And I asked him if he was through. He said, yeah. I said, Brooks, here's the deal. You're really lucky to know a good people as I am. Now, I guarantee you, that took his breath and he left. And to let you know, I mean, you know, it was a couple of months before I got drunk. Had my last drink in Big Spring in Shelby's front yard. And the drunken crap that was coming out of my mouth was, how do you practice these principles in all your affairs? I didn't know how to do that. I wasn't willing to do that. But I came back in here, and I'd punished AA before in that first year. I mean, I got mad about something and quit going. They kept having meetings, so I went back. And, you know, I didn't have any other place to go. I just didn't. And I went back, and Joe was there. He got me in there and told the secretary to get that card out and said, you know, Smith, it says here, I'm your sponsor. And I said, yes. Here's the deal. You'll either agree to go through all these steps with me, or we'll tear this card up and get you a sponsor. If you're not willing, I'm not willing. And I'm looking around, there's three or four people in there, and I said, Joe, I don't feel good anyway, but yes, I'll do that. And so he had me put a new date on there, and he agreed to continue to be my sponsor, and we got into working the steps of recovery at Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's the things that we do here. Certainly we admit and accept, and we uncover and discover and discard. I was a guy in living that got just as sick as my secrets. I was a guy that got restless and irritable and discontented like the doctor talks about. I'm a guy that ran on a lot of self-will and the sun went down every day and it got dark. So how are they going to know what I'm doing? And that's the way I operated with a lot of secrets. I started doing things in a positive manner. I was able to get comfortable in my own skin. And things got good. Now, I wasn't comfortable in meetings until 10 or 11 months. I didn't feel any better after the meeting than I did before the meeting. And then something happened, something changed. It's kind of like going to your first AA meeting. You may not remember what they said to you, but you do remember how they made you feel. That's that AA warmth that I didn't get the second time around, but I finally earned it between 10 and 11 months, and I got comfortable where I was. And things went along, and I was an active member in AA. I found out what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I found out about what alcoholism was and was not. I found out how a guy like me could live sober and treat the illness that I have. I always enjoyed what David, when he is alive, would say. He said, you know, I not knowingly murdered anyone, nor have I married another man. Now, he said, everything else in between, he said, I could have done it. And that shoe fit me like it fits a lot. And AA did become a sober way of life. The principles here, and I had to find out what they were and find out how to apply them. I've always had a home group. I still have one. Barbara and I were talking before the meeting. It's kind of ironic that they hadn't called today. They always have difficulty, even while we're gone, on setting the timers. You may think that's not a big deal, but they think it's a big problem. They don't know how to set a coffee timer. But they left us alone. In living, I went along. I guess the handle I'd put on it's the old school. I was brought up to, I didn't think that you ever got a divorce. I lived in a home with a wife and three kids for a long time. And it's a pretty fancy joint. But that's the way it looked. It's kind of like in here. See, everybody in here looks real, real good on the outside. But how are you really on the inside? That's where AA works. And I lived in those circumstances. She used to be active in Al-Anon. She quit going. And I kept going to meetings, and I'd go see a guy that was drunk, and I might bring him to the house. And if he got drunk again in 2 or 3 weeks, I might go see him again. I might bring him to the house. And I got scolded over and over and over for that. Now, he didn't stay there. She just told me that he didn't want to stay sober. And I shared with her that she really didn't know. See, I don't think for me that this is a genetic thing. I've got a brother that drinks. He drinks him several beers every day. It doesn't interfere with his life. He goes to bed about 9:15, 9:30, gets up about 5. He makes a hand. He's all right. Pardon me, I got a sister that lives over here. I really tell everybody it's my brother's sister, but she's mine too. That she lives over here in North Richland Hills, and she needs a drink. And I believe that. And she's someone that would lead you to believe. She's mother had her going to Al-Anon early on. She didn't like it. And she's got a key to the church, I'm sure, over there. She always had one. She did when she was in Wichita Falls. And the thing is that, you know, she's still mad at my dad for his drinking. And Dickens, he died in 1984. So that really is not working out too good for her, I don't think. But I'm going to give him the privilege to go and to do and to be. That's none of my business. None of my business. I've learned everything in here the hard way. And we all pay a different price. It's kind of like the lady said. You know, everybody has got a load to carry. It's how you carry the load. Now, I like that statement, and I share it quite a bit. And I was surprised to find out who said it. Lena Horne is the one that said it. And she, I'm sure, had a load to carry in this thing called life. And I went along, and this gal and I sat down one morning with her, and I told her, I said, you know, I said, you got more coming out of this thing called life than you're getting out of me, and I'm going to go see the lawyer, and we're going to get a divorce. And she Okay. And all the kids were raised, they're gone. And I go tell the lawyer what we're going to do, and he said, fine. He tells me a few things that I'm going to do, and I said, okay. And rocked longer, and it wasn't for any other reason other than to get out of the situation I was in. I've never said, period, that she's a bad lady, because she's not. She's a good woman. It's just one of those things. The only reason that I probably shouldn't... See, when I was a junior in high school, my dad had a drinking wreck. He always drove a four-door Fleetwood Cadillac and one of them little old Nash Metropolitan things that's about 8 or 10 foot long run into him, turned him around and turned him over on its side. Now, the attorney said that she wasn't driving but 30 mile an hour. But it killed the girl. And the thing is that her dad owned most of West Texas. And probably a year or so later, when I was a senior in high school, they had a trial. And when the trial was over, they said my dad was guilty. And they sent him to Huntsville. And I remember leaving up there and drinking and going down there. And he told me that I had to do this and I had to do that. And I told him, well, what I did instead of that was I got married to where I didn't have to go do a lot of those things. I've always been selfish and self-centered and self-serving. And we all got through that deal. And he came back. And but I never got rid of that knot I had in my stomach about that situation. I didn't know how to get rid of that kind of stuff. And here I was, me voting to let's go get married. Hell, I wasn't even old enough to get married. We had to forge my name and notarize it, and we done all that forging. But, you know, it's a situation that we did that. And so anyway, eventually, be grateful if you can put it on your gratitude list if you've not experienced that. And there's a lot of stuff goes with it. And it eventually happened. And she's still around town today, and she's still there, and she's still a good woman. I stayed single for a while, met a lady. And you never know what you're going to do till you walk in those shoes. And this lady and I visited one another and went a few places. She was a sober member of AA. And she was sober a little over, I guess, 6 years at the time or seven. And we ended up getting married and we were doing all right. And everything went good. And probably a year and a half, 2 years later, she didn't feel good. And in this crowd tonight, we've got a lot of diagnosticians. I mean, if there's something wrong with you, you can see them after the meeting because they know. And it doesn't make any difference if it's something with you or something with your vehicle or if it's an airplane you got at the airport. It's just brilliant. And so she got to go into the doctor, and like all of us, doing things like we want to. And x-rays and this and that. Blood tests and blood gas tests, and I had to talk down south at a conference, and I told her, I said, what we're going to do is go down there in the motorhome when we get back. I said, we'll just park it at the hospital out there, and I've made arrangements, and you can go in there, and we'll find out what's wrong. And she said, fine. And on July the 1st of 1985, we checked her in the hospital. On July the 10th of 1985, she died. She is a little over 7 years sober. She is an active member in AA. And she is 44 years old, and she wasn't ready to die, but she did. And she had liver cancer, and she didn't know it, and I didn't know it. And back in that time frame, wasn't anything you could do about it. I learned in here what you do, you bury the dead and you go on about the business of living. And that's what I did. I been in business there in Lubbock since 1968. And I really can't multitask. I can't run a business in Lubbock and one over at White River Lake. And we owned a business out there that she took care of. And now I'm supposed to be running two businesses. And I'm not that talented. And we were in the people business at the lake and owned a treatment center, alcohol and drug treatment center. And when you're in the people business, you got to be there. So I called that oldest boy. He's in Amarillo, he and his wife and two kids. And I made a deal with him and give him half of the store in Lubbock. And I said, I'll pay this, pay that, whatever, just if you're willing. And he's still there today. And so I started doing things that I needed to do. My wife, Barbara, that's sitting there today, she was an ex-patient of White River. I remember seeing her when she came in, she weighed 75 pounds. Now she's recovered from that. And that's okay. That seems to be what we do in here. And y'all are to be congratulated on the feed back there. It's excellent. And I would call Barbara and ask her about this and ask her about that. And she'd say, Bob, you can't do this. It'll jeopardize your license. Oh, I said, okay. And I knew how to follow criteria that I needed to have. And I did that. And Barbara gave me some good instructions for a long time there. And a little over 3 years later, well, she and I got married. And she had two daughters. Her dad lived in San Angelo. I called him, asked him about the deal, and he said, it's okay, Bob. I knew him. And I talked to the two girls. She and I had a good meeting prior to any of this. And I said, look, I've been in situations where there's lip service and there's arguing and there's this and that. And I can stand here tonight and share with you very openly. We've been married a little over 24 years, we've never, ever had an argument about anything. All to me an argument is a power struggle, and we don't have that in our life. We actually are free, and we're experienced this thing called freedom from the bondage of self. And that's a blessing that we've earned in AA. There's too much happened to me in my life. But to dig back into a deal that I skipped over, I mean, we hear people whine around and, hey, I've had a bad day. I've had this bad day. And they really don't know what a bad day is. You know? I remember I think it was 1977, I had people coming in the front door of the store. And I've never got the count right. It was either 27 of them or 28 of them. They was just a bunch. And they came on in, and I knew the leader. And he had a stack of papers about that thick. And it was on legal stuff. And he said, Bob, I'm over here to tell you that we're arresting you. I said, really? Oh, yeah. And they went through that process. And some stuff went through it. In fact, I mean, Baxter and I were over at a thing, and he's real good with the tools he has to work with, and he looked it up, and he says, Bob, that's you. And I said, oh, yeah. I probably, and really, the terminal uniqueness, if I wanted to create it, I'm the first person in the United States to actually be in the law books guilty of this. And I didn't aspire to be there, but it happened. And it happened in Lubbock, and then we had a little deal down there at the Fifth Circuit, and it again happened there, and they all said guilty. And I never denied doing what I did. And the wait was on, and they finally, that U.S. Marshal, I knew him, we drink coffee together, he come over to the store, and he says, Bob, says, you're to be in Safford, Arizona. This is about 9 months later. I said, okay, where in is Safford? He told me. I got in a new Cadillac, drove it out there, and I had it parked down at another place, and I go in a place, and there's no walls or anything around. They had a little bitty rock thing about that tall. It's about this wide. They said, don't go across it. That's 5 years. Hell, I ain't going across it. And I was out there for a little over 2 months, and I came back, and I've carried that load. I gave them every day they had coming. I know about being on paper. I know about serving parole. I know about somebody saying I'm guilty. And it's the truth. I just didn't know it was against the law. And because I wasn't into law breaking then, nor am I now. So, you know, that really wasn't a good day when that 28 agents came in there of the federales and arrested me. I mean, it's something that was talked about a little casually earlier between me and someone else that had had a little federal problem. I said, I guarantee you, as mentally impaired as you are, you still remember your number. He said, oh, yeah. I said, me too. But you see, where I went, they didn't have any AA meetings. I got a group going. Several of us got together. We had a big book. We did some things. We did it in an AA manner. And it was okay. I know we're not really supposed to promote that much, but I did. We got in a van, we went to town, went to a meeting. Now that got their attention, and that happened before. But you see, it was okay. They allowed us in because we were there because of our problem in recovery. I know this about Alcoholics Anonymous, so far as I'm concerned. The very first time I ever tried AA, it worked. The other stuff before AA, it wasn't AA's fault. It was mine. I didn't do anything. I still go to meetings. I still work with others. This thing of suiting up and showing up has always been a priority. Joe, it didn't make any difference. Whatever it came down the road that I felt like was negative, I had to turn it around and make something positive out of it. And he taught me how to do that. It's just like when my wife died. I said, Joe, what about this? He said, no big deal. Nothing you and I can do about it. She's in God's hands and she doesn't hurt. So we put that over here on a gratitude list. Be privileged and grateful that you had the lady in your life. It's kind of like my Al-Anon mother. We buried her probably 4 years ago. She didn't go to Al-Anon for me or for my dad. She went to Al-Anon for herself, and she's a little over 90 years old. She is still going back and forth to the meetings. And she made a hand. She was active. And we could see Al-Anon alive and well in what she did. And it wasn't just lip service. It was action. There's a lot of difference in here to me between activity and action. And action is where I'm wanting to be and where I try to stay. Action is where people get well and people start living free. And, you know, it's... We've got... Barbara had two kids and... I've got the three. One of mine, I've never had 5 minutes of trouble out of him all his life. The other boy, he took up the slack. My excuse there, it's really not an excuse. I just tell, he's an Aggie. And I just tell everybody that he's overeducated for his intelligence. And any of y'all that had the privilege to know Jack when Jack was alive, This boy and I had butted heads. I nearly helped the boy to death. I got him out of 3 or 4 DWIs and this and that. The last encounter he had was down in Bryan, and I'd already drew the line. I said, no more. And that was, he got the privilege to have him the first sitting with one of those mad mother judges. I don't know how it worked out. I just know that, you know, he did what he had to do. But he was living over in Keller and having a few problems. He called me and told me about his wife and he were having a few problems, his temporary separation. He said, I temporarily rented her an apartment over there for 6 months. And I said, yeah, that sounds temporary. And as I visited a little more, I said, what if I had a friend of mine get a hold of you and y'all do a little visiting? And he says, you've got a friend in Fort Worth. I said, oh, yeah. And, yeah, I said, well, if he calls you, will you answer the phone? He said, oh, yeah. And he's sober. Sober and miserable. Untreated alcoholism. So I call Jack, and I tell Jack the deal, and he got a hold of him. Probably a week or 2 weeks later, and, I mean, this is completely out of context for Jack Henning. I promise. Jack calls me, and he says, Bob. I said, yeah. Well, he says, I owe you some money. And I said, that's good. And, I kind of got to pay attention to this deal because he and I didn't call one another and fess up to that much. And, he says, I went to UT. And I said, oh, yeah. And he says, all this time in Alcoholics Anonymous said, I have always wanted one of them Aggies, and I finally got one. And I'm here to share with you that the Aggie, he lives up in Kansas City, and he's still sober. He's still sober. When we buried Jack here a while back, he came down for the funeral, and he was there. Jack helped that boy, just like he helped a lot of other people. Out of, I've got a daughter, and she's not an alcoholic, she's just a drunk. She gets in jail, and she wants out. She gets DWIs and doesn't want to have to pay the price. But her kick is this, but see, you don't understand, my case is different. I said, I ain't getting you out, no more. And that's her problem, not mine, because I had to go to Al-Anon to learn how to release and release with love. Out of the other two daughters, one of those is a real alcoholic. Bless her heart. She called in one time from Oklahoma, I think, and Barbara told her, says, let me tell you what, don't call me back till you get sober. Well, you didn't hear from her for over 3 years. Really? Now, that's really, the girl might not have heard her mother right, but that's the way the game played. The other girl, she's not one of us, but she knows everything. Have you ever known a hairdresser? That's what she is, and she knows everything. And not that it's all the way down to Dallas or Fort Worth, but in West Texas, all these hairdressers know everything. And she don't share, she tells. And but the other one, she came to see us for, she's going to stay 2 or 3 weeks. That is a little over 6.5 years ago, and she's still there. But she's there, and she's sober. I lost my sponsor a little over 4 years ago. All down through time, it's a thing that, Joe would tell me how dumb I was. Now, it's not that I ever took that in a negative way. We went on a big trip one time, and Barbara and I talked before we went. We wanted to go to Alaska. We had some friends up there, and we had friends along the way, and we'd bought a new motorhome. And really, that's kind of a test when your sponsor and his wife is going to follow you. all this way. Of course, we're up here and they're back there, but bless her heart, she talks all the time. And I'm sure she's back there helping Joe with her talking. But so Barbara and I made the agreement that the only way that they'd ever be able to make the trip is if they did follow us up there. And so that's what we did. And we took off for a little over 2 months and went up there, drove 10 or 12,000 miles, had a good time. And we came back, and in some later years, well, Joe didn't feel good, and he's limited on what he could do, and various times in the hospital. But he had never forgot telling me how dumb I was. He'd say, "You know, Bob says, God loves you, and I'm trying." I never did write that down. I could always remember it. And he's a kind and gentle man that let me come in his home over there. And he had a wife and 3 kids. And he's the one that let me go through those steps with him. And I found out things about him. And I didn't know it took him about 4 years to get a dry date. And I said, "Really?" And I didn't know that he's living in New Mexico, and that he and the DA had this come to Jesus meeting over there and said, "You know, Bob said I had to leave town. I had to leave town before dark, and if I didn't, they was going to send me to penitentiary." So New Mexico run him out of the state. Of course, I was still a little arrogant, and I said, "Joe, New Mexico is not a very big state." But the old man loved me back to health, and he loved me all through the thick and thin, and I always used him on what I was fixing to do. And if it was okay, I did it. If it wasn't okay. He taught me so much. Probably 15 years before he passed away, now he says, "Now, Smith, I want you to really," I think Barbara and I was by there drinking some coffee, he says, "Now, I guess you know that when I pass away, you're going to have to do my eulogy." I said, "Oh, yeah." "You need to be careful what you say, because there's people here that stuff you say." And his wife heard it. And when he passed away, well, the next morning, well, his wife called me, and she says, "Bob," and I said, "Yeah." She says, "I guess you know that over at the funeral, you're going to have to do Joe's eulogy." I said, "Now, Jackie, I don't know about that." I said, I probably would get that mixed up, messed up. And I said, "Well, you think about it a little bit, and I'll call you back." And probably 10 or 15 minutes, the daughter called, and she says, "Now, Bob, that's what Daddy wanted you to do." And since I've been sober, probably that's the hardest thing that I ever did, was stand up in a room completely full of people from all walks of life and share a eulogy of Joe Turner, a man that saved my life, along with you people. And we did what we did. And then we buried the dead, and we went on about the business of living. When Joe got sick, had him in the hospital with a bunch of stuff running in and out of him, and in this particular intensive care section where they didn't have but about 4 or 5 people that a couple of nurses were looking at, and it's a thing that Joe says, "Smith, I want to go outside." I said, "We can't." "Yeah, that's what I want to do." I said, "Well, you talk to her about that. I just come to visit." And now I've already talked to her. She's not in a good humor, and I can understand that. And we'd have a good visit. I'd hold on to his old hand, and I'd say, "Well, Joe, I'm going to go down to the shop." And he said, "That's fine." Smith says, "Just remember, God loves you, and I'm trying." So I'd go back the next day. And we'll go through kind of the same drill and talk about some stuff. And whenever it was time for me to leave, well, he says, you know, Bob, said, God loves you, and I do too. And I guess that's the first time I remember that old man telling me that he loved me, although I knew that he did. I earned his trust and I earned his love through action in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a thing that was given to me a long time ago. It's something that impressed me then, and in sharing it, I'll sit down and let you all eat the rest of what you got. But it's a story about the old farmland couple. A man and woman lived out on that old Blackland farm down here in Georgia, and they had two kids. A boy and a girl. And they didn't have much. The old man had been clearing off some timber and this and that and selling it, and he's sitting there one night. The family was having supper and says, ask his wife to get that little old catalog and said, look through it. Said, I'm going to have a little extra money after I sell this timber, and said, I'll let you buy something for you or buy something for the house, what you'd like to have. And after they had supper, well, she got it out and looked, and in the time frame and the way it was listed, she bought a looking glass. They had no mirror in the house, and that's what she wanted. So he got a little amount of money together, and they fixed up the little order and asked little Jack to take it down to the mailbox, and the mailman picked it up, and he had kids running down there every day, very impatient, about like me, running in there, jerking on his mother's shirt tail and apron, and when are we going to get our package? And it's a thing that went along, and she'd just tell him that it'll be here before long. And finally the day came, and he got him a box, and he brought it to the house, and he brought it in and told his mother, says, Mother, we have got the present, and I'm ready to open it. And says, no, son, says, tonight, after your dad comes in and after we have supper and we clean off the table, we as a family will sit down here, we'll open the box, and we'll share it. And that sure wasn't quick enough for him, but that's the way they did it. And that night, after they'd cleaned off the table, and the man's wife got up and handed the box to her husband and says, babe, the present came in, and little Jack is really wanting to see the present. And so the daddy opened the box up, and he got it out, and he looked himself over, and he had some old wife beard and some hair, and he looked and tugged and pulled, and he hadn't seen himself in the mirror in years and years and years. Handed it over to his wife, and she looked at herself, and she pinched a little bit and fluffed up and got the cheeks to where they was a little bit rosy. Handed over to her daughter, and she looked at herself and did a little fluffing and a little pinching, and handed it down to little Jack. Little Jack looked at himself in the mirror, and then looked at his sister and his mother and his dad, and looked back in the mirror again. And he looked up and he says, Mama, says, why do I not look like y'all look? Says, over here doesn't look right. All said, Jack, says, when you was just a kid crawling around down there in the stable, said a horse kicked you upside the head and maimed your head and your face. But, says Jack, we've always loved you just because you're you. And you see, that's exactly what the people in Alcoholics Anonymous have done for me. I thank you.